We get the hour underway by welcoming to the program a music legend, singer, songwriter, music producer, original member of Jay and the Americans. He's been making music ever since the late 1950s. He's worked on a number of films, including Eddie and the Cruisers, American Hot Wax. He was musical director of Saturday Night Live and appeared in a number of films, including Manhattan, Crimes and Misdemeanors, Husbands and Wives. We had a chance to catch up earlier today with the great Kenny Vance.
I'm happy to be here. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you. Been a fan of your work for a long, long time. And well, let's go back almost to the beginning and back to the late 1950s. What was it that drew you to the Brill Building as a young guy?
Well, before the Brill Building, it was Alan Freed came to New York. Alan Freed is the disc jockey that is credited with coining the term rock and roll. And he came from, I believe, Ohio, Akron, then Cleveland, and then he came to New York. There was a failing radio station, WINS, at the time. And it was a 50,000 watt station. And they put him on in the night.
Doing the Moondog Matinee, right?
You got it. You got that right. And he started to play rhythm and blues records. And it just created a revolution. And I guess around 1956, he decided to, you know, like he decided, hey, let's do a rock and roll show at the Brooklyn Paramount. And, you know, probably not knowing if it would be successful or not, but you know, they ran this show, I think, for 10 days, and thousands of people showed up every day, and they did 4, 5, 6 shows a day. I remember as a kid, I think I was 13 years old, I went down, I took the subway down there, and I was online, and I went in, and Chuck Berry was there, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Buddy Holly and the Crickets, the Heartbeats, the Harp Tones. Mm. And somebody that really excited me was Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love. And Frankie Lyman was a 13-year-old kid, and I was 13 years old. And that kind of, you know, blew my mind. And, you know, I think then you'd listen to Alan Freed and you'd get a couple of friends. And maybe I grew up in Brooklyn, and you'd go down in the subway, and because there was a great echo chamber there.
Yeah, looking for an echo.
We were looking for an echo, and we started to imitate the songs that we heard on the Alan Freed show. And slowly, you weeded out the guys who could sing and the guys who couldn't sing, and we started a group. And there was a guy in the neighborhood who had a record company in the 1697 Broadway, which is the Ed Sullivan Theater building, where the David Letterman did his show all those years. And we went there and we auditioned, and they signed us up, and we made a record. And
was that the Harbor Lights?
The Harbor Lights. Yeah. And Cousin Brucey started to play it on his radio show. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we became celebrities in our neighborhood. And a couple of years, and then we wound up with a manager in that 1697 Broadway. And he managed groups that were successful, like the Mellow Kings, Tonight by the Mellow Kings, yeah. and the Mystics, Hushabye by the Mystics, and the Passions, and up there also was Paul Simon using the name Jerry Landis and the guy by the name of Al Cooper, and who wound up with Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Yeah.
And
Al has been on our show.
Yeah. And so you know, Al is quite a force in the music business. And we were all 15 years old, and we were up there. And then we met Jay Traynor up there, because Jay Traynor was the replacement lead singer of the Mystics. Is this too esoteric?
No, or? This is fantastic. I love this history. That's great.
Oh, okay. And so we decided to start a different group. And a friend of mine, a friend of ours in the neighborhood, an older guy, he was working up at Jerry Lieber and Mike Stola's office in the Brill Building, which was 1619 Broadway. So we wound up going down there and auditioning. We sang Wisdom of a Fool by the Five Keys. And Jerry Lieber and Mike Stola signed us up, and they wanted to call us Binky Jones and the Americans. And Jay Traynor freaked. And they said, well, what's your name? What, you know, his name is John Traynor. And they said, well, my nickname is Jay. So they said, all right, Jay. And on the desk airline tickets, American Airlines. And they said, how about Jay and the Americans? So
you could have been Jay and the Pan Ams.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, it's true. So that went down, and you know, we made a record, and basically they stuck with us. And the second record that we put out was Dawning, and the flip side was She Cried. Mm. And if you listen to Jay Traynor's performance on She Cried, or any of those records that we made, but that one, which became a huge top five hit in America, he was 17 years old.
My God. Wow.
17 years. So the next time you're driving in your car or you listen to, I don't know if you play records now.
We sure do. Absolutely.
Well, if you want, you could play a little bit of She Cried and hear his vocal. The guy's a killer. And I guess if it wasn't for him, you know, we wouldn't have had a career, but the guy, his vocal at the age of 17 was just, you know, phenomenal. And it became a big hit. And we stayed together for only about a year after that, because in those days, like all the people that had preceded us, like the Chantels and the Dubs and the Flamingos and Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, if you didn't have a follow-up hit, your career was over. And our career was basically over at that point. And, you know, we stopped recording, and about a year went by, and we called Jay Traynor back up, and he, I think he was given some offers by other people like Phil Spector and other people to make some records, and he didn't want to do it. And so we wound up with Jay Black, and, you know, for the next 10 years, we had, I don't know, maybe 10 top 20 records and sold millions and millions of copies over the years. And that lasted until around 1972.
Well, and you guys were great. You had so many wonderful hits with Jay Black. But Cara Mia was a showcase for his vocal talents, but Come a Little Bit Closer. And for my money, one of my favorite songs, I think one of the great songs of the decade, is Walking in the Rain.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was originally by the Ronettes.
Right.
And we covered it. We wound up up until like 67, 66, 67, we had Come a Little Bit Closer, Let's Lock the Door, Cara Mia. But then things cooled off. So we didn't, you know, there was a British invasion and everything. We didn't really know what to do. So United Artists, the label we were with, they got us a lot of different producers. So we got Jimmy Miller, who was the producer of the Rolling Stones. He produced a record with us, but right. It wasn't us really. And then Joe Wizard, who produced the Turtles, he produced us. Burt Bacharach produced us.
Right.
Van McCoy produced us. None of it worked. So we said, well, let us do our own recordings. And so we went into the studio. I remember like it was a four-track studio. And we decided, you know, why don't we do a tribute to Alan Freed? And we started to do oldies. And one of the oldies that we recorded was This Magic Moment. Mm. And in 1969, it was the biggest single we ever had. It sold 1,600,000 singles.
Wow.
And it became top five. And then the follow-up to that was Walking in the Rain. And his vocal, Jay Black's vocal on that is tremendous. I think Donald Fagen is playing the piano and Walter Becker is playing the bass on that because the last incarnation.
Well, they'd come into your office, right? And you said, yeah, maybe if you guys can do some arrangements, we can find a place for you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and they joined up. They were our backup band for the last incarnation of Jane and the Americans, which was 1969, 1970, and then they left and they wound up going out to California. And I think in 1972 they made the Can't Buy a Thrill album with Reelin' in the Ears and Do It Again on there. So
I want to go back a little bit. We're talking with Kenny Vance here on Downtown. Well, you mentioned Lieber and Stoller. I just finished reading your friend Richard Perry's wonderful memoir, and he tells a story in there about the two of you going to audition, thinking you were going to audition for Jerry Lieber, but it ended up being Mike Stoller. And according to Richard, it didn't go all that well.
You know, I love Richard, and we've been friends, you know, since those early days. And unfortunately, he's not well at this point. Thank God he completed his memoir. It's quite a beautiful book, isn't it?
It is indeed. Absolutely.
Really a beautiful book. And he actually did the first three chapters he did an audio book of those before he got really sick, and he was unable to finish the audio book of his book. But if anyone who's listening, it's called Cloud Nine, and it's by Richard Perry, probably one of the greatest record producers, you know, ever. I mean, I just hit for a second, you know, his body of work. He produced Tiny Tim, Tiptoe Through the Tulips. He produced the Leo Sayer, You Make Me Feel Like Dancing. He produced the Pointer Sisters. He produced
Carly
Barbara
Simon.
Streisand. Yeah. He produced You're So Vain, which is probably one of the greatest recordings of all time with Mick Jagger. And I think it's George Harrison playing the guitar on that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
And I was engaged, I think I was about 18 years old. And we had, you know, we had a hit record, She Cried. And Richard was, I was with my fiance at the time. And Richard, who I didn't know, I'm stopped at a red light in Brooklyn with a convertible in my father's car, and Richard pulls up on a motor scooter, and hey Marilyn, how you doing? And this is Kenny, and he's in Jane and the Americans. So wow, you know he was in a group called the Escorts.
Right.
On Coral Records, and they were produced by Dick Jacobs, who produced Buddy Holly.
Yep.
So Richard, you know, was no stranger to the business, and he said, hey, why don't we get together? And I went over to his house, and we started to write songs. And I guess they were okay, you know, but, you know, when you write something, you feel good about it. You don't really, I don't know, maybe you don't have a barometer to know if it's really good or bad. So he says, well, let's play it for Jerry, you know, for Jerry Lieber. Now, Jerry, I was a kid, you know, in retrospect, they were only 10 years older than me, but Jerry was very outgoing, very colorful character and very creatively special. And I had a warm feeling towards him, And I think he shared that with me. Mike was more of a, you know, technician, I believe, played the piano, created the melodies, and, you know, collaborated with Jerry. But he was a more of a jazz head. It was a different type of guy. I didn't really have a frame of reference as a kid for what that was. So I never really did connect with him. And so I make an appointment to see Jerry Lieber. And I sleep over at Richard's house.
you rode on his scooter? Is that part of it true?
And we get outside and we take the scooter through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel up on the Henry Hudson Parkway in those days. It's no longer there. We get off at 49th Street where the Brill Building was. We head up to Broadway. So we get in front of the Brill Building. He chains the bike up to the parking meters, and we go in. In those days, you know, the elevator operators, and the elevator operators knew me, I knew them. And we went in, and we went up, I think it was on the 9th floor, and we walk in, the secretary's, Bonnie was there, the secretary, and I said, oh, we're here to see Jerry. And she says, he's not here. She says, do you want to see Mike? And I thought, oh no, you know, this is not going to be good. You know, we were there already. So I said, okay, fine. So we go in, and Richard has had a booming voice and a very large presence. And he sits down, and Mike comes in the small little cubicle, and Richard starts playing some this song, and Mike is sitting there, and I look at Mike, and I see that he's not with this at all. So I start to like remove myself. I start backing up in the room, and Richard continues on. You know, he soldiers on, and Mike. It finishes, and Richard's waiting for, you know, his response, and he goes like this. I don't know if you can see me. He goes like
just a shrug of the shoulders.
A shrug of his shoulders. What can I say? So he says, "Oh, we got another one." So he goes, he plays another one. So, you know, we left dejected and, you know, whatever, you're kids and, you know, you just keep going. So now, I don't know if Richard put this in the book, but many years later, he's producing Barbara Streisand. And every writer in the world is trying to get their song on her album. So all of the top writers at the time, Randy Newman, you know, that ilk of talent was looking to get the songs. So he gets a call from Jerry and Mike, and they come up there. They come up to his house, and they sit down at the piano and they start playing in material. And he said to me, he says, I wanted to go like this.
I love it.
He says, but I didn't do it.
Oh, that is such a great story. Kenny Vance with us here on Downtown. I wanted to mention too, with Jay and the Americans, not only the great success you had as artists on the charts, but touring, and you had the distinction of opening for both the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in their first U.S. performances.
Yeah, that's true.
What was that like?
So it was February 1964. The Beatles, I think they were on Ed Sullivan the week before. And we took our train down from Penn Station to Washington, D.C. The show was taking place in a huge arena, and they had a plywood on the floor because there was ice on the floor. It was a hockey arena. And there was a stage set up, and we come in and we go back in the back, and there's the Beatles are there sitting at a dais and with microphones, and this press like talking to them. Now, we had been doing this since 1960, and this was never in the mainstream press. You'd never hear about Roy Orbison or about Little Richard or any of these people. This was some, you know, it was like your father's newspaper in those days, right?
Yep.
You know, and you know, you never had any pop culture in there. So right there it was a trip. And then I remember after this press conference, you know, we were all together in a room, and they were like us, really. They didn't know what was to come. And they said, oh, we heard of you guys, you know, because they knew the Ronettes had gone to England when Be My Baby was out.
Right.
And so we had played with the Ronettes at the Murray the K Show in Brooklyn, and we were friends with them. So we heard of Jay and the Americans. So we, whatever. Anyway, we went on. I guess there were 20,000 people there. And, you know, we were singing our hits, Come a Little Bit Closer, Only in America, She Cried, whatever the hits were up until that time. And you know, the crowd was, you know, it was fine. They were happy to see us. And we were wearing these suits, these Dickies, and we were doing steps.
All choreographed.
Choreographed steps. I mean, we were emulating, you know, the vocal groups of the 50s. That's
right.
You know, the Drifters and people like that. That's the school that we had come out of. And the Beatles were like a guitar band. It was like, what's that? You know, nobody really had an idea. So anyway, they made an appearance up in the top corner of the stadium. Like there was a couple of tiers, and they were surrounded by about 20 cops, and they came out, and the place let out a roar that was like a kind of a roar that I imagine that, you know, you heard when Babe Ruth hit his 60th home run. It was just like this, I had been into the Brooklyn Paramount, and I had been to the Brooklyn Fox. And so you knew about, you know, wild audiences, but this was something unworldly. And they came down and they plugged in, but it was like really before Led Zeppelin and The Who and people like that. So the equipment really was not conducive to having a huge sound.
Right. You didn't even have stage monitors, did you, in those days?
No. You know, so they were playing and you couldn't hear a thing. And every time they shook their heads, you know, and the hair moved, the place went even crazier. So that was it. It was just like an event. It wasn't necessarily a musical event, but if you heard what they were playing Twist and Shout, Gone to Kansas City, Larry Williams song, Dizzy Miss Lizzie. That was basically what they were doing. And then they did a couple of their own songs, you know, like She Loves You. So, you know, basically that was it. And then on the way back, we wound up on the same train as they did. So we're in the train with them, and the train comes into Penn Station, and it's like a scene out of A Hard Day's Night. And you see, you know, you thought people were going to fall in the tracks. Thousands of people were there. And, you know, you close up to the door, and the door opens, and they go, oh, it's only Jay and the Americans. And so, like, all of a sudden, the crowd parts. I'll never forget this. The crowd parts. And they allow us to walk out, and I wound up going upstairs and catching a cab back to Brooklyn, where I lived. And I got in, and I thought, what just happened? I mean, you know, because it was just, it was, you know, in retrospect, that roar that went up was really the roar that echoed in a whole new consciousness, right, a whole new way of dressing and a whole new way of thinking about things. And because, the, you know, if you think about it, and for me, you know, I love the fact that, you know, these people were into meditation and they introduce you to, you know, the Swami, you know, all of this stuff. And then you listen to their albums and they were breaking out of the mold that we had been in,
right,
all those years.
Absolutely.
The 1-6-4-5 progression. Not that there's anything wrong with that musical progression, because some of the greatest songs of all time have been written, Earth Angel and The Still of the Night and on, This I Swear. And so, you know, that was pretty wild. And then about, I don't know, maybe 8 months later, we get another call to open the show for the Rolling Stones at Carnegie Hall. And anybody that's in show business knows, like, if to play at Carnegie Hall is like, you know, is the greatest thing you could do. And we go to Carnegie Hall and, you know, we come out. And of course, the crowd is happy to see us. And, you know, we do a show. And then the Rolling Stones come out. And we were in the same dressing room as them. And I remember Bill Wyman. He was just basically leaning up against the wall, chewing gum. And they would, like, you know, they were just nonchalant about it. And the place was going crazy. And so the disc jockey was Murray the K. And now there's a second show. So he comes backstage and he says, you guys got to close the second show. Because if you don't close the second show, there's going to be a riot.
Wow.
So we said, we can't follow these guys. Are you nuts? He says, you got to. So anyway, the Rolling Stones come on, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and Charlie Watts and Brian Jones. And we actually took some pictures with them that I've never been able to find, and in the dressing room. And then Murray the K comes out, the Rolling Stones go off, and he says, right now from Brooklyn, New York, Jay and the Americans. So our opening act, number was Only in America. And we come out and we're doing those steps, right? While we're doing the steps, the audience is getting up and running out the back door. And they obviously were running around the back to try to catch the Rolling Stones while they were leaving. And we finished the song, and we had cleared Carnegie Hall.
Wow.
And so, you know, we packed up, and I thought to myself, I better get a guitar.
Kenny Vance with us on Downtown. I want to make sure we talk about some of your film work, because you've done some terrific work in movies, from Eddie and the Cruisers, but I want to focus on one of my favorites, and it goes back to the beginning of the story in Alan Freed. We just had Lorraine Newman on a couple of weeks ago talking about a great movie, American Hot Wax.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's I think Grail Marcus from the Rolling Stone magazine many years ago, when it first came out, he said, this is the most emotionally accurate movie ever made of these times. Mm. There's a spirit in that movie that did capture what it was about in those days, going to the Brill Building, where Alan Freed's office was, and booking the show, and then the Brooklyn Paramount. The energy there, you know, was incredible. And basically had just that the previous year had just released an album on Atlantic Records, produced by Joel Dorn, and Looking for an Echo was on that album. And the powers that be at Paramount Pictures out in California, a friend of mine, Don Phillips, and they heard Looking for an Echo. And even though it wasn't successful at the time, like Looking for an Echo took about 20 years for it to become like a cult anthem.
Right.
But what happened was they had heard that song and they said, man, this guy probably would be good guy to be the music director of the of this movie and to put the show together. Let me think. So they flew me out to California. You know, somebody at Paramount Pictures, they had a transportation pool. They picked me up and they drove me to Melrose Avenue. And I got out and went through the gates and there was a fake sky there. I had never been on a movie lot, you know, and I went in to meet the people and they hired me. And so then I came out to California and we dressed the Wiltern Theater on Wilshire Boulevard to be the Brooklyn Paramount. And, you know, to me, it was simple because I knew what it was supposed to feel like. I knew what it was supposed to be.
Sure.
I put a band together and we hired Chuck Berry. And I got to spend, you know, a couple of weeks with Chuck Berry, and we got to hire Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and we hired Jerry Lee Lewis and Frankie Ford, C. Cruz. And we actually hired Larry Williams, but he never really made the final cut. And then I was in the truck. And because in those days you had a 24-track truck that was recording the show live. And they said, well, we need this group, like a group to be Danny and the Juniors or the Del Vikings or something like that. So I said, well, yeah, I probably could do it. I used to sing in a group. And so a friend of mine, Vinny Poncia, who's from Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
He turned me on to the Brooklyn Dreams.
Oh, Bruce Sedano.
Bruce Sedano, Joe Esposito, and Eddie Hokanson. And we bonded and we became Professor Laplano and the Planetones. And we wound up, you know, doing a couple of songs in the movie. And we've remained friends. As a matter of fact, there's a right before the pandemic, we did a YouTube video called a song we wrote called Brave Companions.
Yes, I've seen it. It was great.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And so you see, we've maintained our friendship all these years.
And you've got your son Lad singing with you as well.
Yeah, now. Yeah. Oh, that's thrilling. Really, that's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
Well, you've had an amazing career. It's so great that you're still out there making music. Been a fan of your work for a long, long time, Kenny. Appreciate you making time for us this afternoon. So many more stories we didn't get to. I hope we can do it again at some point.
Yeah, no, this is fun. I look for. Oh, yeah. Give Lad a call and we'll hook it up. I got a couple more stories.
I bet you do. Thank you so much, Kenny.
Nice meeting you.
Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Okay. Have a good day.
You